This is Rick Malone for the San Francisco Symphony. All of Anton Bruckner's symphonies have more or less tortured histories, and his third is no exception. Bruckner was notoriously insecure about the worth of his own compositions, and this led him to allow almost anyone with a comment or criticism to suggest changes, and sometimes even to make them themselves. Bruckner completed his third symphony in 1873, and it's full of allusions to and quotations from Wagner's Die Walküre, Tristan and Isolde, Tannhäuser, and Die Meistersinger. Bruckner had presented the symphony to Wagner, who was obviously flattered, and his dedication reads, "In deepest reverence to the unattainable, world-renowned, and exalted master." But the first performance in 1877 was a disaster, and several of Bruckner's well-meaning allies took it upon themselves to edit the symphony for publication. Bruckner wrote in large blocks of sound and very rarely connected those blocks with the kind of transitional elements that most earlier composers had used. Wagner, on the other hand, was all about transitions and the gradual unfolding of a theme over a large arc. The irony of what happened to this symphony is that Bruckner's friends cut out most of the Wagner quotations in order to make the whole thing sound more like Wagner. Not only that, but Bruckner himself revised the symphony several more times, which means that what he originally wrote was essentially buried beneath layers of changes, and it wasn't until 1946 that Bruckner scholars finally came close to sorting it out. Bruckner was once on a walk in Vienna with a student, and they passed a building where the body of an eminent church architect lay in state. But they could also hear dance music coming from a nearby pub. Bruckner said, "Listen, in that house they're dancing, but there the master lies in his coffin. That's life, and that's what I wanted to show in my third symphony. The polka represents the fun and joy of the world, and the chorale represents its sadness and pain." End quote. Beethoven's Ninth Symphony cast a long shadow across the music of the 19th century. Pretty much any symphony that came later was compared to it. Some composers, like Tchaikovsky, Mahler, and Sibelius, embraced the challenge. Others, like Brahms, tried to avoid it as long as they could. Bruckner paid tribute to Beethoven's Ninth by beginning several of his own symphonies in the same shroud of mystery. Over a quietly expectant buzzing in the strings, a trumpet plays a quiet fanfare. One by one, the orchestra carries this thought up to a mighty fortissimo. That fortissimo arrives with a descending four-note figure, repeated immediately in a five-note variant, and rounded off with a cadence, the five notes going up rather than down. The sudden drop in volume is a dramatic shock. The opening trumpet theme, the short descending phrase, the cadence, and a lyric string melody provide all the material for the first movement. The quiet mystery that Bruckner set up in the opening sets the mood for the development section as well. There is a grand build-up to what appears to be the recapitulation, with the entire orchestra playing the opening trumpet theme in unison. Bruckner is not quite finished with the development. Bruckner presents the first of his Wagner tributes as he works his way toward the actual recapitulation. The oboes play the figure that opens the Liebestod, the love death from Tristan and Isolde. And the strings suggest the sleep motif from the magic fire music in Die Walküre. These quotations will return in the finale, along with phrases or gestures from Tannhäuser and Die Meistersinger, Beethoven's Eroica, and Bruckner's own Mass in D minor. When the recapitulation finally does arrive, the trumpet theme returns softly, with even quieter echoes in the horn. And the drama returns to bring the movement to a close. The key of E flat is tonally unrelated to D minor, where the first movement ended, but when Bruckner starts the second movement in that new key, you can hear how fresh and open it sounds. The viola introduces a new theme in waltz time. Accompanied by shimmering violins. Bruckner's biographer Robert Haas wrote that Bruckner was inspired by the realization that he was writing on his mother's birthday. Bruckner follows that melody with a succession of gentle themes. At the end, Bruckner alternates a blazing fortissimo with softer and more intimate passages. These are the kinds of great pillars of sound that confused Bruckner's audiences. gentle echo of Wagner's Die Walküre becomes a bridge to the movement's contemplative conclusion. The scherzo also begins in mystery, but then breaks out into a high-energy dance. The trio takes us into the Austrian countryside. The movement's opening theme returns with a bang to round out the scherzo. The finale begins like a quietly whirling perpetual motion machine, which provides the background for the movement's first big theme. New section at a slightly slower tempo is actually two melodies together, a polka in the strings and a chorale in the brass. This is the passage Bruckner was talking about as he walked through his neighborhood. The polka represents the fun and joy of the world, and the chorale represents its sadness and pain. Bruckner brings back his tributes to Wagner's themes as well as his own, but subtly, as if he's hearing them only in his mind. Finally, the first movement's trumpet theme returns in a triumphant and blazing finale. There are so many versions of Bruckner's Third Symphony, and all make some kind of musical sense. How to choose? Well, the San Francisco Symphony's conductor laureate Herbert Blumstedt uses Bruckner's original, or at least the version that Bruckner thought was final in 1873. As Blumstedt says, why should we not perform the Wagner Symphony as Bruckner presented it to Wagner that remarkable day in Bayreuth? End quote. This is Rick Malone for the San Francisco Symphony.